The Money Show with Motheo Kgaripe on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Monday edition of The Money Show. It's been a pretty wet day in Johannesburg, but far worse in the Western Cape, where it's been a gusty one ripping through homes and schools as well. So hopefully everyone is warm and keeping quite safe, especially in the Cape of Good Hope. Tonight, we ask you not to adjust your televisions because a major media deal on the continent on the cards. A French media giant Canal Plus, or Canal Plus, whichever way you want to pronounce it, has improved its offer to MultiChoice shareholders to 125 Rand a share in a bid to merge with the owners of DSTV and Showmax. Duncan MacLeod, the founder and editor at Tech Central, has been keeping quite a keen eye on that potential deal, especially since it's due regulatory approval and shareholder approval as well. We'll be getting the details from him beginning of the show. Then some of the world's largest retailers have come together like a group of superheroes, if you will, to initiate a new collaborative retail venture capital fund that is looking to invest around $125 million over the next 5 years in the world's most innovative startups and scale-ups with the potential to transform the retail space around the world. We'll be looking at that particular fund and what it's looking to achieve. I know that the likes of ShopRite Group holding hands with Woolies Group in Australia and New Zealand, other retail as well involved in that particular one. Even Walker, portfolio manager at 36 One Asset Management, will unpack that for us. Then our markets will be covered by Merrill Pick, a rebound day for the JSE today. She, of course, the portfolio manager at Old Mutual Investment. Later on the show, we look at our business book feature. Tonight, we're reading Same As Ever, A Guide to What Never Changes, that book by Morgan Housel. Ian Mann, a regular book reviewer here on The Money Show, and the MD at Gateways Business will be joining us for that particular conversation. Later on, How I Make My Money. This time we go to the gaming and esports world, talking to Sam Tech Girl Wright about how you particularly make money from games. You'll need to hear that later on the show on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Motheo Kgaripe on 702.
Well, there was an offer in February. Canal Plus going for MultiChoice, looking to join hands on that takeover deal. But do you know the shareholders at MultiChoice were not too impressed with the first offer and the price given then. But it seems today a rebuffed offer, an improved one of 125 Rand a share, could lead to the merger between Canal Plus, the French media company, and the pay TV giant here on the continent, MultiChoice Group. Joining us for this particular conversation is Duncan MacLeod, the founder and editor at Tech Central. Duncan, welcome to The Money Show.
Matteo, thank you. Good to be here.
A major one for the continent. You can see what this merger would mean in terms of competing with the likes of Netflix and all the other streaming giants coming for the viewers here on the continent. But in terms of regulatory approval, it can get a bit sticky.
It can indeed. And certainly we saw in the detailed statement issued by Canal Plus and MultiChoice today that they see Netflix and other U.S. broadcasting and streaming companies like Disney and others as a potential threat on the African continent. And in fact, many view the African continent as the last great opportunity for media and broadcasting industries, companies to compete and to stitch up the market, particularly in the streaming space, which is still quite nascent in the African context. But this deal, for it to go through, there are some significant hurdles that they are going to have to get over. And people I've been speaking to suggest that getting over the restriction contained in the Electronic Communications Act, and just to remind your listeners, that restriction states that no foreign broadcaster or no foreign entity may hold more than 20% of the voting rights of a South African-owned broadcaster. At face value, it appears that Canal Plus is already beyond that. They've now have now acquired 36.6% of MultiChoice Group's equity, although the Electronic Communications Act may in fact be referring only to MultiChoice's South African operations. It still raises some very difficult questions for Canal Plus about how they could get this deal over the line if they aren't able to hold more than 20% of the voting rights in the South African operation, which is one of course, MultiChoice's most important operations, if not its most important operation. So it's very difficult to see how this deal can go ahead, although both MultiChoice and Canal Plus are now saying, we'll work together and we'll get the circular out to shareholders. So there's definitely been a warming of the relations between the parties, and it appears there's willingness to cooperate with one another to get this deal done. But I can't see it. I can't see how this gets across the line with that current restriction in the legislation and no chance of it being changed for at least several years.
It seems shareholders could have their hands twisted here, in that, you know, the first minimum price given was 105 per share. At 125, the valuation of MultiChoice now at 55 billion rand, they could be licking their lips, saying this is probably worth the trouble of trying to get it over the line.
The shareholders may indeed vote in favour of a transaction like this, but ultimately, I believe it is the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, or ICASA, which in effect looks after or enforces the Electronic Communications Act, that will be the ultimate arbiter of whether this deal will be allowed to go ahead. And on a strict interpretation of what the law says, it's very difficult to see how it could possibly go ahead. Now, Canal Plus's CEO has already said that Canal Plus sees a way around this potential problem, or around this, not potential problem, it most definitely is a problem for getting this deal done. But he has said that he sees a way around this, but Canal Plus hasn't said exactly what that is. I was expecting some more detail on that in today's announcement, but it wasn't forthcoming.
I think the way to get around it would probably dual list at a particular point, but also make sure they meet muster, and also make sure that in terms of shareholding and ownership, there's still black ownership, because that's also one of the requirements. Yeah. But just a lot of wires tangled there, if I can use that wording, in terms of getting this deal through. But looking at Canal Plus, I mean, they're no stranger to MultiChoice, started investing in 2020. And they mainly operate in the Francophone part of the continent. If these two giants came together, it would be quite a serious challenge to those streaming giants if the deal does come through.
Yeah, definitely. I think these two businesses are incredibly complementary. Both are big operations across. Both have big operations across the African continent, and as you say, they're not in the same markets. Historically, MultiChoice is targeted Anglophone Africa, and Canal Plus, not surprising being a French company, has targeted Francophone Africa. So together they will create a more powerful organization with a stronger balance sheet that is better able to invest in content and the sort of local content that will actually ultimately decide who is the winner in the race to be the dominant broadcaster and streamer on the African continent. And I think the two companies together could be a very powerful combination. But again, it's going to be the question of whether this can get past the regulators.
All right. I think that's the hurdle. That's the snag that could trip up this particular deal. The owner of Canal Plus, of course, is Vivendi. I thank you so much to Duncan McLeod there, looking at that particular story. He's the founder and editor of Tech Central. An interesting one for the continent in terms of pay TV and streaming. Vivendi looking to merge with MultiChoice, helping to, I don't know, have a bigger front, have a bigger a pocket to fight the likes of Netflix, Disney Plus and Hulu. The deal is subject, of course, to shareholder and regulatory approval from the Competition Commission.
The Money Show will give you all the tools you need to navigate the complicated world of economics and commerce. Even if you're not a numbers person. The Money Show.
With Motheo Kgwaripe.
6 to 8 p.m. Making money makes sense.
On 702 and Cape Talk.
Well, they're not the Justice League or the X-Men, but a group of retailers around the world have joined hands to start a big, big fund that will be funding innovative and small businesses in the retail space, looking to make sure that the retail sector remains sustainable. The W23 Global Fund brings together five global grocery leaders, including Ahold Delhaize from the US, Europe and Indonesia, Tesco, which is predominantly dominant in the UK and Europe, and the likes of Woolworths, Empire Company in Canada, as well as Africa's biggest retailer, Shoprite, coming together to start a fund that is looking to spend around $123 million to make sure that they scale up and help those innovative startups to improve the retail sector. Joining me for this conversation is Evan Walker, Portfolio Manager at 36ONE Asset Management, a key driver for the sector, potential one, given that they're looking to, expand those businesses that are going into fintech, going into improving the logistics networks in terms of retail.
100%. I mean, this is quite an interesting transaction because this really is five big heavyweights around the world looking to put all their ammo in one basket, to call it. I mean, really, and obviously fire up some innovation. I think this is just the start of AI, artificial intelligence around the world, and obviously these big retailers want to be at the forefront of that and make sure that they've got companies to support them. You rightly mentioned both on the fintech side, the logistics side. I mean, these are going to be two sort of pivotal areas of growth for big retailers. And then lastly, just understanding customer dynamics and changes and trends and buying patterns. I think artificial intelligence is going to help them significantly in that front. Just understand the dynamics on the customer base and just where they can improve their service levels and obviously pricing and those pricing algorithms that come to us every day from a competitive point of view and stay at sort of cutting edge. So, yeah, this is five big retail heavyweights. I mean, obviously Shoprite, the big one in South Africa, but obviously looking to stamp its dominance on technology and be at the forefront of sort of global innovation.
Evan, somebody looks at this and says these are major retailers that have built their own table and they're trying to get dibs on the latest technology to come through in retail. Is that a fair assessment, or is it good for them to have come together and found their own solution?
Yeah, I think, look, you mean these are businesses that are obviously not competing against each other, so it makes sense that they come together. I mean, obviously technology is very vast, and I mean, they're all using different components, or in some cases they're using similar components of technology. I know the likes of Shoprite does travel around the world to see other retailers in different parts of the geographies and understand what they're doing. This has been a long-standing process from all our retailers in South Africa just to understand what the global dynamics are. But I certainly think coming together, and Shoprite is, if we look at Shoprite's margins today, I mean, they are leading edge margins, similar to its counterparts around the world. So certainly standing there with the very best, and obviously they want to stay in that framework and progress from there. But certainly you can throw all your money in one pot and stir that around a little bit. Hopefully the innovation that comes out of that will be sort of tenfold rather than twofold if you were doing it on your own.
I guess it would be a good way to look at it, given that the funding pool here in Africa is not as big as the US and the rest of Europe. If you do have a fund that's looking to grab onto innovative companies, it would be a big opportunity, especially in those companies playing in that logistical and fintech space.
Yep. I mean, rightly so. I mean, certainly there's a much bigger pool of innovation. And you're obviously throwing your cash into that pool. Likewise, we've obviously got certain levels of innovation in South Africa, and we do rely, to a large degree on foreign participants coming in to obviously drive that higher. I mean, obviously the back end of a lot of these retailers, even in South Africa, is driven by the likes of SAP and Oracle and certain big tech businesses that are situated in South Africa, the Microsofts of the world, etc. But from a small scale. I think what also needs to happen in order for these retailers to become a lot more efficient, they need to help their supplier base become that much more efficient. And that supplier base can often be way smaller companies, companies that haven't got the ability to ratchet up and spend what they have, and certainly being able to go downstream and you know, collect information from them and certainly help them, I think will drive a lot of innovation in that small part of companies. And you know, that's where I think hopefully the likes of ShopRite can benefit, you know, more local entrepreneurs, is to drive that sort of competitiveness within their supply base as well and help their suppliers be more efficient, which obviously benefits the consumer ultimately overall. You know, everyone benefits to that degree.
This is also a healthy knowledge sharing ecosystem because, of course, like you're saying, they're not competing companies, but they can learn from each other because they do operate in different markets.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's a clever strategy. You know, I think the problem with technology, as we know, is you know, for every 100 million you throw at a problem, you've got to probably throw a billion to really get the final solution. So, I mean, this is a start. As I said, I think what prompts this now is just the sort of speed at which we're seeing artificial intelligence come to the likes of big business globally. I think big business is going to be the biggest beneficiary of artificial intelligence, whether it's global banks, global insurers, big global retailers. I think that big businesses are going to be able to certainly integrate this way more efficiently in their businesses and drive efficiencies and productivity faster than smaller businesses. But smaller businesses are going to have to tack on to that, and that's going to be where you're going to be, you know, having to sort of bring guys in, and you're going to need smaller innovators to help you, you know, bring guys into the net and facilitate that interaction.
All right, that was Evan Walker, Portfolio Manager at 36ONE Asset Management, talking about that W23 Global Fund. Now, this is a collaboration between major retailers around the world, the likes of Tesco, ShopRite here on the continent, and Empire Company in Canada, Woolworths Group in Australia and New Zealand, coming together and creating that venture capital fund of $123 million. A big take for those small companies that want to scale up, want to play in the innovative space, especially in retail. But talking about the other deal that we chatted about earlier, the Kennel Plus and MultiChoice joining hands. Kennel Plus offering, of course, 125 Rand a share to MultiChoice shareholders. We have a WhatsApp that's come in here from AJ in Cliptown, is saying, it's worrying to hear of the DStv deal with foreign companies. This while we as shareholders have never received any communications from MultiChoice. Emails have been sent and we tried to call them to no avail. Can you try and hear from them what can be their challenge in making sure that they communicate to the rest of their shareholders? Hopefully we'll get MultiChoice on the show once we get more clarity on this particular deal.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Rebound day for the JSE today on the markets. It was a day where we looked at the JSE, especially after that good day we had on Thursday. But Friday was a little bit more disappointing. So a big week in terms of economic data coming out of Europe. We'll be having that interest rate number coming out of Europe, but also in the US inflation number expected this week. So I was quite worried that starting off on Monday that the JSE would be weaker on cautious trade, but it had rebounded by 560 points on the all share. Industrials were still down from Friday, but insurance and banking stocks were up more than 0.5%, while mining shares were up 2.5% today. Some of the biggest winners on the top 10 of the top 100 on the JSE, Sibanye-Stillwater picking themselves up from the weaker trades that we saw last week, up 8.5%. Northam was up more than 7.5%, with the likes of Sasol also in similar territory. Pick and Pay, better side of things. We know they've had quite a rough time on the market, losing a lot of their share value, but today up more than 5%. The MC Group was also up 5%, with HCI up 3.5% on the market. MTN Group on the weaker side of things, they were down 3% today. Bidcorp also down 2.5%. Retailers, Mr. Price, Pepco, the likes of Bidvest also in negative territory today, while Vodacom then joined MTN Group, down by more than 0.5%. So it was generally a good day on the market for those companies that traded high, especially in the mining and banking sector. But of course, that rebound day, will it last with all the economic data coming out today? Merrill Pick joins us now for the breakdown on the markets. Looking at this particular rebound day, Merrill, is it anything else that's pushing it except for a rebound?
Yeah, good evening, Mateo, and good evening to your listeners. Look, I think markets have been under quite a bit of pressure, particularly the commodity sector, perhaps was due for a bit of a rebound. I think any slightly positive data out of the US, we saw some positive data out of Germany, I think can spark a bit of a rally. I think in particular we've seen some of the commodity prices edging higher over the last 2 to 3 weeks, gold in particular, Brent crude, and there are various drivers of that. You know, to some extent that can even seem contradictory. Gold is associated with bearish times and risk off, and oil, you know, oil going up is associated with strong economic demand. So why are these two things moving at the same time? And I think it is because we just have such a multipolar world emerging right now. Geopolitical risk rising, different factions, different allegiances, and various commodity markets being driven by different things. For example, in the gold market, you know, the demand this time around really seems to be driven by the Asian countries or the developed market central banks, yeah. Asian consumers, the developing market banks, whereas Western investors are selling gold. So there's this divide emerging more than one place. We look at the oil market, although demand is a bit weak in Europe, in China, etc., the supply is being affected by geopolitics. And so something like Sasol today up 7.5%, probably rightly so, given that Brent crude is at almost $90.
Some analysts were talking about that $100 mark for the oil price, especially with the uneasiness that came with the tensions in the Middle East. Given that Israel has now withdrawn from southern Gaza, do you still see that price going up?
I think it's all about, at the end of the day, it's all about supply. It is a marginal withdrawal, I from what I understand. I'm not a geopolitics expert, but from what I've read, it's a reasonably token or marginal withdrawal. Could it be the first step, you know, in a complete ceasefire and withdrawal and bringing the parties to the table? That remains to be seen. You know, I think there are other regions or other tensions that are affecting this. You know, the Red Sea, for example, and then to some extent, Russian sanctions actually taking effect. While at the same time, demand has just continued to be a bit stronger than expected, particularly in the US. You know, so that market just remains tight. And the question marks around actually how much spare capacity is there really within OPEC, in particular within Saudi Arabia, that should the demand hold up, is the spare capacity genuinely available to come online?
All right, so I think that Brent price around that $90 mark, stubbornly so since last week. The market's fairly in a good place today. Our market commentary, of course, covered by Merrill Pick, portfolio manager at All Mutual Investment Group. Thank you so much for the chat.
Motel Faripe on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Welcome back to The Money Show. If you've just joined us, we started talking off around the Canal Plus and MultiChoice, a potential takeover deal that could happen there. Of course, Canal Plus coming back with an improved offer of 125 Rand a share to those MultiChoice shareholders. The deal could still be tripped up by regulatory approval, especially from ICASA. But some of you are already picking up a pattern from the French companies hungry for a better stake here in Africa. Mpo Motap or in Rustenburg on the WhatsApp line saying the DSTV French deal is interesting in the media space. French companies seem to be having a great appetite on South African companies. I remember a while back, JC Decoux, an out-of-home company, bought over Continental Outdoor, which had a stronger foot footprint on the continent. Basically, a rush for Africa again, but this time through a corporate, could be happening on our continent. But let's get now into the world of commodities. I had touched on it in our markets wrap. The price of oil still quite stubborn around that $90 mark. There's even odds of $100 oil price that we could reach given what is happening on the political front, the geopolitics that is currently driving up the price, but also some of the biggest oil producers around the world. Oil prices slid more than $1 a barrel this morning, with Brent falling below the $90 mark. But as markets closed on the JSE, it reached that $90 mark again. Chatting now to Mohammed Dokrat, portfolio specialist at 91 Asset Management, to get a sense of where the oil price is likely to go. We all, of course, are interested in this because it could drive up the price of either fuel, that is petrol or diesel. And if you are a business owner that has a few trucks, you'd want to be listening to this. As a consumer looking at an inflation price, you also want to be looking at this. Mohammed, welcome again to The Money Show.
Hi, Matteo. Thanks for having me.
A lot of nervousness
on
the market last week as that price got driven up. But what happened there in Syria with the killing of an Iranian official, and how that drove up those tensions there in the Middle East? I was still going to see the price go further than this $90 mark.
Look, unfortunately for your listeners, I think we're likely to see upward pressure on petrol and diesel prices at the pump for the next few months. You know, as you pointed out, it has been really a perfect storm for the oil price, driven by supply disruptions all over the world. So yes, in the Middle East, you've got the oil tankers taking the long route around the Cape to bypass the Houthi attacks on the Red Sea. And the market has obviously gotten more anxious about a retaliation from Iran in response to last week's consulate attack. For context, Iran's about 3% of global crude production, so it would be quite significant if there is any disruption there. But further than that, you know, you've seen in Russia, AI-enabled long-range Ukrainian drones are striking energy infrastructure deep into Russian territory, which has forced them to cut crude production. You've seen U.S. supply, which consistently beat last year and reached a record high in December, also down this year because of freezing cold weather in January. And in Mexico, for example, also the state-owned company has slashed their crude exports as they plan to increase domestic refined production ahead of their elections. So in spite of all of this turmoil, we've also last week had OPEC agreed to extend their existing production cuts to the end of the second quarter and enforce stricter compliance among its members. So the sum of all of this is you've got a counter-seasonal decrease in oil inventories in a period when demand was supposed to be quite weak. And as a result, you see an upward pressure on the oil price.
This is more than just a perfect storm. It sounds like everything is quite aligned for that oil price to go up this year. Would it be as bad as we saw when the Russia-Ukraine war broke out all those years back?
Look, I guess obviously, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the headlines and chase the momentum, but sometimes, you know, we just need to take a step back and look at the fundamentals. So will oil reach $100? Yes, perhaps it might touch this level, but I don't think it's sustainable. And the sort of key reasons behind that is, yes, we've got supply disruptions at the moment, but OPEC has almost 5 million barrels of spare capacity at the moment per day. And over the past 2 years, they've been forced to withhold production to balance the market because there's been a surge in supply coming from the Americas, you know, US, Guyana, Canada, Brazil. And as a result, they've had to take barrels off to balance the market. And so, you know, as oil starts pushing above $90, you know, with the dollar, you know, the dollar as strong as it is, borrowing costs high, for emerging markets especially, there's a real risk of demand destruction coming through, and that could obviously moderate prices again. And OPEC have the spare capacity, which should act as a buffer against any potential supply shocks. So yeah, they've got their next official meeting on the 1st of June. I think if oil price is at $85, then they probably stick to their quotas, and you could infer that they're worried about demand. If oil is where it is now and demand is strong as we head into summer, then you know, you could see them bring back some barrels to the market and help ease the conditions.
What's the safest play here for the Organization for Oil Producing Countries, OPEC? Because we know that they've been sticking with their production cuts for the longest while now, but things are playing out and there's other factors touching on this oil price.
Yeah, again, if they had to keep production cuts in place with oil at $90, I mean, that really means it's more of a political signal than a fundamental signal, and could be sort of, you know, them trying to influence potentially the outcome of US elections, for example. So I guess for now, you have to take them at their face. They are trying to balance the market. They've done that in a period when demand was supposed to be weak. But as we start moving into the Northern Hemisphere summer, you know, you've got summer driving season starting from the 1st of May in the US, and that's usually when you get your strongest period of demand. So they should be able to therefore bring back some barrels to the market and help ease the supply tightness at the moment. And then, of course, you know, the US also isn't an election year, and spiking prices for motorists does not bode well for them politically. So, you know, you could see them use their strategic petroleum reserves again. We saw them draw down on this quite significantly in the onset of the Russia-Ukraine war in 2022. And this had quite a material impact on prices and helped to contain it once it had overshot to $130. So, yeah, the US does have less sort of inventories than they did before Russia-Ukraine. But they are now, you know, pretty self-sufficient in terms of their own domestic crude production. So, do they really need to hold 6 months plus of strategic reserves when the market is tight?
And it's happening during an election year where you definitely want to keep the prices of at least energy and products quite low. You know, that inflation number coming through out of the US on Wednesday. That was Mohammed Dokrat. Thank you so much for that conversation. A portfolio manager, portfolio specialist rather, at 91 Asset Management. Not bearing the best of news that South Africans can expect the increased prices of diesel and petrol, with that oil price expected to touch that $100 mark.
The Money Show will give you all the tools you need to navigate the complicated world of economics and commerce. Even if you're not a numbers person. The Money Show.
With Motheo Paripe.
6 to 8 p.m. Making money makes sense.
On 702 and Cape Talk.
Back here on The Money Show, we're about to get into that tech feature, Tech with Toby, talking around the Energizer backup battery. I don't know, I'm the kind of person that I should be charging at night, but sometimes I forget, and I should be carrying one of these superchargers walking around to make sure that I still have connection throughout the day. I take with Toby today covering the Energizer battery, the backup battery that you can use to plug your small iPhones or either other Android models that you want to use to make sure that you have consistent power. I know we haven't had load shedding for the longest time, close to 2 weeks now, so a lot of people will be looking into other energy options should we have that load shedding come back. Power banks, which one should you be getting today? We're looking at the Energizer Tech with Toby. Toby Shepshak, of course, are joining us now. Toby, what's different about this particular power bank? People will tell you I can buy a power bank at the corner store, but is this one, you know, promising to last more than others?
Well, what's immediately significant about it is that it comes with a built-in handle. I mean, that just gives you a sense of its size. It's large capacity, and it's physically large. It's a 50,000 milliamp battery. It has the ungainly name of UE5001PQ.
Yeah, I thought I'd let you say it.
It's a great battery. It's kind of halfway between a power bank and a power station. It'll give you 180 hours of backup battery for a smartphone, 60 hours for small tablets, 40 hours for a large tablet. It's got a USB-C port, and it's got a built-in battery. But what's significant about the USB-C port is that it'll charge at 65 watts, which is enough to charge your laptop, most, you know, MacBook Pro or any of the high-end Intel laptops, Dell or HP or Packard Bell, any of those devices will use a 65-watt charger. So you can get a pretty substantial charge out of this. The three USB-A, that's the old square shape, do 22.5 watts, which is more than enough for most smartphones. And a very handy thing to have, especially with the built-in lights. And I mean, we haven't had load shedding. And I was reading Chris Yellen's op-ed in the Daily Maverick today about how, you know, the drop-off in demand is partly caused by, you know, fed up and frustrated South Africans who've built their own solar systems at home, put panels on the roof or batteries, and, you know, so have businesses. So in a reverse way, you know, we've become self-sufficient from electricity. But this is, you know, if you haven't put on a grid, or you're not renting a grid via the on a monthly basis, because there are lots of options for doing that. This is a very handy solution. It'll give you light. It'll give you a whole new power. You know, you can recharge your battery on a laptop, and you can keep your phone and tablets going. So pretty substantial, 50,000 megawatts and milliamps, megawatts. That would be very handy in a thing this size. It has a built-in handle, and you know, this is the kind of thing we have to do in this day and age. You need a solution, and for 1600 rand on Takealot, it's a very fair price, I think. In case I didn't mention, it has a built-in light, which in of itself is entirely handy.
I mean, back in the day, you know,
One of the other things I've recommended for ages is you can buy, they're about $100 each. You can buy these LED lights, and they have a couple of hours of charging them. There's a local brand called Gizu, J-I-Z-Z-U. They make them. A couple of the other brands also make them. And you buy these light bulbs. So they cost, you know, an LED light bulb will cost anywhere between 30 and 50 rand. But for 100 rand, you get one with a battery. It charges while it's on. And then when you have no power, you can turn the light on, and actually it turns these, you know, LED batteries. And LED is a very efficient technology. It uses very little power, but gives you a lot of light, as opposed to, say, you know, incandescent light bulbs that we all grew up with. Incandescent because they create light, but the way they create light is by creating heat. So they use lots of electricity, and they heat up, whereas LED doesn't. It creates a lot of light, but it doesn't create a lot of heat. So very efficient ways for solving the load shredding problem without having to, you know, rent or buy a big solar system.
If this was another time, I'd say this was camping equipment. But it, given that we don't have consistent power supply in the country, is something else we should be looking at in terms of backup power, especially if you're out of the home, maybe on a long drive, or trying to make sure that your phones are on for all the meetings that you have around the day. But wouldn't you say it's a bit cumbersome then for somebody to carry to the office?
I mean, most people's office circumstances are have some kind of power backup by now. There'll be a generator, or there'll be an inverter system or something. I mean, the offices stuff rents have a ginormous generator, but also have put in solar panels because, you know, there was so much talk about a nuclear reactor. Well, we have one. It's in the sky called the sun, and it beams down 300 days of sunlight in Africa, you know, every year in Germany, which certainly doesn't have the amount of sunlight nor the, you know, intensity of it that we do. They've managed to use solar in a highly effective way. So we, you know, we should be taking advantage of it. And we are, as statistics show. You know, South African public have created the equivalent of a kusile in solar panels on our roofs in the last 2 or 3 years. So we've created this, you know, energy supply for ourselves. But if you aren't one of those people and you need a more cost-effective solution, this is a very good one. For 1600 rand, this Energizer 50,000 milliamp power bank, there is only one on Takealot, I checked earlier, is a very good solution that'll keep your digital devices powered up so that you can carry on working. Or if you have such a system and you're going away on holiday, or you're worried about, you know, staying in an Airbnb or a, you know, a holiday place that doesn't have enough power, and you want to make sure, you know, your tablets are charged up so that the kids can entertain themselves for an hour on a Saturday afternoon so you can have a schlof. This is the solution.
I was looking at the number of inlets in this particular battery, because Energizer, of course, is known for its AA batteries, AAA batteries. But, you know, in terms of power banks, you know, are they trying to be now the leading brand in that to make sure that families can now buy this type of technology to make sure that when the power is out, everybody
knows their devices? It's an obvious and a brand extension for them, or product category extension, which is much larger power banks, and they have been doing it. In fact, my favorite 20,000 milliamp power bank is made by Energizer. It's got a 50 watt output. I mean, it's a 65 watt output. It's by far the best device I've seen of this kind, but they just weren't selling in South Africa. So they dropped that and they have that. You get lots of other Energizer. If you go look at the, you know, Energizer category on any e-commerce site, you'll see they have lots of options in this range, in power banks. And of course, they also make power stations, which are the much larger, you know, you can plug a three-pronged plug into them, kind of situation, which is, you know, also great, because there's a need for that kind of backup when you are going. And, you know, if only it was when we were going camping that we needed these kinds of things and not any other time. But, you know, I noticed there was a big push for these power stations in the US camping market for years before, you know, the application in Africa, where we have such unreliable power supply, became obvious. And a bunch of local brands have grown up around that, which I also think is great. Good all round.
Well, not just good for your remote batteries, but also quite good, it seems, in terms of power banks. Energizer coming out with that powerful power bank. 180 hours, you said, of charging on smartphones, eh?
Yep.
All right. Still facing...
You will be able to post to social media forever.
Facing tough competition, though, from the likes of Romos Azus and Taroma solar power banks. That stiff market, of course, becoming quite popular in South Africa because of our energy crisis. Toby Shevchek, chief at Stuff Studios, joining us for Tech with Toby tonight.
The Money Show with Motheo Kgaripe on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Just after 7, now getting into the workings of Eskom. I think the conversation of late is everyone shocked, really, on how we haven't had load shedding. People asking each other not to jinx it. We've had about close to 2 weeks of lights on and no load shedding, and we all don't want to talk about it because we might just jinx it. But just to get the answers on why we've gotten so much light of late, is Chris Yelland, an energy analyst and MD at EE Business Intelligence. Chris, a good sign that maybe Eskom is marching the right way, or a bad omen in that a lot of South Africans have moved away from the grid?
Well, it's a bit of both, to be honest. There certainly has been an improvement with less unplanned breakdowns occurring in the first 13 months of this year compared to the same period last year. This has given Eskom a bit more space to do maintenance. So they've increased the planned maintenance outages and are doing higher levels of planned maintenance this first 13 weeks of the year compared to the same period last year. So the two are kind of balancing each other out, and therefore the availability of the Eskom fleet is actually about the same as it was for the first 13 weeks of last year, because whilst the unplanned breakdowns have reduced, the planned outages have increased, so the availability has stayed about the same. But we are experiencing very significantly lower levels of frequency of load shedding, as well as the intensity, the level of load shedding, in this first 13 weeks. And so people are asking why. And it's really because that demand for electricity, of Eskom electricity, is reducing year on year, and it has been doing so for several years. And the private sector has come on board very significantly in the last 2 years and in this year. And this is bringing more supply to the grid, which is relieving the burden on Eskom so that it doesn't have the same levels of load shedding. So the more the private sector can supplement the electricity supply, the better. And also the price of electricity has been going up dramatically. This is causing customers to really look carefully at their electricity consumption and save it in all possible ways because of the affordability issue. So we've been seeing people installing solar hot water geysers.
Yeah.
They are, and this doesn't just apply at residential level, you know, across the board, residential, commercial, industrial, mining, agricultural level, people are trying to use electricity efficiently and use it only when absolutely necessary for price reasons. So the price is also having a big driver on demand for grid electricity as people move to alternative energy sources. The business case for these alternatives are becoming better and better as Eskom and municipalities continue to put up their prices at many times the rate of inflation.
And of course, as consumers of this electricity in South Africa, we've all had our own conspiracies on why all of a sudden we've got this power. I mean, elections are coming up and we're thinking, the lights are on, so we could, you know, go to the polls with a different mindset. But looking at what is happening at Eskom, the fact that we've had close to 2 weeks of this power, does it mean that by the time we get to the big consumption season being winter, we'd still be facing a situation where the lights are on and there's less demand, or things should change when it comes to the weather getting colder?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is, yes, I hear these conspiracy theories all the time. People suggesting that this is just an election tactic before the election, and that after the election, things will go back to the bad old days. I must say, I don't believe these for a moment, these conspiracy theories. You know, these conspiracy theories are mouthed by people that know very little about electricity. They're big talkers, but really, they don't know the underlying issues, and they sit around thinking about conspiracy theories. So I don't believe that for a minute. I think Eskom is working as hard as it can to alleviate the situation and to get things back under control. We're seeing the fruits of it at the moment. In terms of whether winter is going to be worse than summer and that we're heading for a really dark winter, I just want to point out that, I mean, experience and the data shows that the load shedding in winter is not necessarily worse than in summer. In fact, just remember, the very first stage 6 load shedding we had in South Africa happened in December 2019, in the middle of summer. So, whilst demand for electricity is increasing, it does increase in winter,
yeah,
Eskom does less maintenance in winter so that there's extra supply to meet this extra demand. So it's kind of offset. So winter is not necessarily the worst month. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't mean to say that we might have load shedding in winter. There can be. Nobody can predict the future, least of all me or the people at Eskom or the managing director or the chairman or the minister. There can be situations where there are simultaneous failures on generators that plunge one's situation from what might appear to be a relatively good situation and be plunged into a bad situation quite quickly. If a number of generators trip out, you know, at a similar time, it has happened in the past, it could happen in the future. But to say in general that the winter is worse load shedding than in summer is not necessarily true at all.
Then let's look at the workings at Eskom. We do know they carry quite a hefty a debt, and that, of course, caused by the municipalities that don't pay Eskom as well. But looking at the unbundling of the business and refocusing on how Eskom is going to work in future, do you see all these strategies coming together to make sure that there is consistent power supply in the country?
Yeah, you know, the restructuring of Eskom is very necessary, but it's not an immediate quick fix, in the sense that restructuring of Eskom is a process that is going to take several years, many years, in fact, maybe 5 years or more. But we are moving in the right direction, I believe. And this has been driven, firstly, by the necessity to restructure, because the current arrangement at Eskom is simply unsustainable. We just cannot carry on doing things in the same old way that is failing. And secondly, I mean, National Treasury is putting immense pressure on Eskom to restructure. You know, they gave Eskom some bailouts, very significant bailouts, but there were very strict conditionality attached to these, including the restructuring of Eskom, the repayment of its debt, etc. So we're seeing, for example, the creation of the National Grid Company of South Africa, the national, it's called the NTCSA, the National Transmission Company of South Africa. It's taken out transmission sort of out of direct control of Eskom. It's still an Eskom subsidiary for the time being, but it'll become an independent grid company, government-owned. This is not privatization. This is restructuring of transmission as a separate independent state-owned transmission grid company, which will allow a diversification as well as a diversification of energy. That means not just reliance on coal, but also a diversification of generators. So we're going to see a competitive, diverse generation sector emerging, generating into the grid on a competitive basis. We've seen wheeling and trading of electricity across the transmission grid. All of these will enable the private sector to have a greater participation in the business, in the electricity business. Now, this doesn't mean Eskom is going to die or go away. It just means that there will be additional generators, much needed additional generators, that will provide diversity and manage risk. Our eggs will not all be in one basket that is failing, but we'll have a diversified generation sector. All of this is good.
And then looking at that tariff, I think it's 17% now for households looking to get electricity from Eskom. That pricing strategy from Eskom to try and shore up the business is a sustainable one, because a lot of South Africans, of course, in a tough economy, everything is up in terms of products and also interest rates, and having to still pay a whole lot more to get electricity supply. Is it one that's sustainable, or should they be focusing on making sure they're more efficient?
Well, look, Eskom tries to cover its costs. And it says at the moment, still, despite all these increases, that its prices are not truly cost-reflective and that it is not recovering its cost adequately via the tariff. So the answer that they seem to put is, we must put up the tariff because we're not recovering enough. But, of course, this you've got to remember that the more people put up the price of electricity, the more pressure of on them to use alternative energy sources. And the more Eskom prices go up, the better the business case becomes for alternative electricity sources and alternative energy sources. So you see, for example, people are moving cooking away from electricity onto gas. People are moving away from electricity, electric-operated hot water geysers to solar hot water geysers. People are trying to use as little electricity as possible because it's expensive. And this drives efficiency and the use of the minimum amount of electricity. And this puts Eskom's business case at risk. You see, there are diminishing returns to simply increasing the price of electricity because people move to alternatives. Another way of becoming cost-reflective, not just putting up your prices, is to reduce your costs. If you're not cost-reflective, you can also reduce your costs and become more efficient as an organization in order to become cost-reflective. It's not simply a case of putting up the prices. So I think Eskom's got to really look carefully at its whole structure and its efficiency and the way it does business. And if you look at what's happening around the world, moving towards a competitive, diversified generation sector, generating electricity into a independent national transmission grid company drives greater efficiency and reduces the cost structure. And that is also what is very necessary. It's not, it should not be simply a case of putting up the price, because at a certain point you cannot get blood out of a stone. If people don't have enough money, they will not use your product, or they will start stealing your product. And that's the danger.
The curious case of Eskom's renewal. Chris Yelland, an energy analyst and MD at EE Business Intelligence, breaking down there some of the efficiencies that Eskom should be having in future. Nothing is an easy fix. For now, as consumers, we're dealing with a very, very high tariff from Eskom, and hoping that those days without load shedding do last.
The Money Show. Business Books.
Usually on a Monday around this time, we do cover the business book feature. Tonight, we're reading Same As Ever, A Guide to What Never Changes, that book by Morgan Housel. Of course, Ian Mann, a regular book reviewer here on The Money Show, and the MD at Gateway Business Intelligence are joining us for this particular conversation. Same As Ever, A Guide to What Never Changes. The book really looks into timeless principles shaping human behavior, economics, and decision-making. It also looks at the accessible insights into navigating uncertainty in finance and life, and drawing on historical examples and psychological truths. Ian Mann joining us to tell us more about this particular read. Ian, your interest in this particular book, and what did you pick up from it as you were flipping through the pages?
I've read it quite a few times, I must tell you. The book is very serious, and I'll tell you why. We've been trying to predict the future for a very long time. One of the things I think everybody who's the least bit thoughtful knows is that it's absurd to try and predict 50 years in the future, or 5 years in the future, or 2 years in the future. Everything can change tomorrow, and can change because of a tiny, tiny little accident. I don't know how many people would have believed if we told them before that if a virus broke out in Wuhan, it would affect the price of liquor in Africa, or it would affect liquor sales in Africa. Nobody believed that stuff, but it happens. Lots and lots of small things happen all the time. Now, how do we spend so much time trying to predict the future, and what's nice about this book is picked up something that we really, really can predict.
And what are those key themes that come from this particular book?
What he says is this. One of the things we can predict 50 years in the future with great certainty is that human beings will still respond to greed. They'll still respond to fear. They'll still respond to exploitation. They'll still respond to tribal affiliations. They'll still respond to social persuasions. You've got a list of 23 different things, my memory serves me. And what he does is he identifies these things which really they're not going to change. That's why he called the book Same As Ever. Let me just give you a couple of examples and you'll see exactly where he's going to. We're very good at predicting the future, except we're not very good at predicting surprises. Surprises. But what tends to matter most of all is the surprises. Biggest risks are always those things that nobody saw coming. If we saw it coming, we'd be prepared. And the damage happens because we aren't. Risk is really what's left over after you've thought through everything you possibly can. I'll give you an example. He asked the author asked Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize winning expert on bubbles, how inevitable was the Great Depression? And this is what he said. Shiller said nobody forecasted it. Zero, nobody. Housel asked economic historians to name someone who predicted the Depression. No name comes up. You ask yourself, how could nobody have predicted the Depression? There are always two ways to explain something that looks inevitable afterwards. And it wasn't predicted despite the fact that it looks inevitable at the time. Reason is either everybody was deluded or blinded at the time, or it's possible that people are fooled by hindsight. We only understand things because it's in hindsight. The biggest news, the biggest risks, most controversial events are always what you don't see coming. Risk is what we don't see.
Does he then discuss...
Always was the case and it's always going to be.
In the book, Ian, we know the future is uncertain. So trying to be future looking as humans in our human nature. We don't want to delve in that in case the future doesn't suit us in terms of calling, credit bubbles that led to the market crash, calling things that should, move the dial in the normal life that we enjoy. We all love certainty. So looking into the future might be something we're not really looking forward to doing.
But look, that's just one aspect of it. I want to give you another one, a verity, something we know will be true now and will be true in the future. Try this one. There's incredible power in stories. Stories are always more powerful than statistics. And in fact, the best story always wins. Not only the best idea or the right idea, or the most rational idea, but the idea that's called best. A great idea that's poorly explained sounds like a bad idea. And we've seen this happen all along. And sometimes these things can make a huge difference. If you have the wrong answer, but you're a good storyteller, you'll always get ahead, at least for a while. Just think of one example of a great storyteller. Halfway through Martin Luther King's speech, he was giving a speech to 250,000 people. Halfway through the speech he'd written for the occasion, with all these people literally physically standing in front of him, Mahalia Jackson, who's a gospel singer, who was standing on his left, said to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And he looks at her. He pauses for a while, and he takes his text and moves his text off the lectern. He grabs the lectern, looks at the 250,000 people, and he says, "I have a dream. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream." And the rest is history. The power of a story can be so powerful that it can do the sorts of things that Martin Luther King's ideas, covered in a story, can make happen. I think in a perfect world, the importance of information wouldn't rely on the author's eloquence. But we live in a world where people are bored, impatient, emotional. We get complicated, and we need to get complicated things distilled and easy to grasp. And this has always been the case. Now, this is not only true of stories about events, but products, companies, careers, politics, education, culture, everything. The best story wins. It's not only what you say, but how you say it. And that's not going to change. And that's going to be the same now as it is in the future.
Ian, you say you've picked up this particular book a couple of times. There's a reason why you keep going back. What is it about the book that makes you want to pick it up and remind yourself of some of the lessons you're getting from the text?
I think that they're very profound lessons for business, for everything else. Let me give you a couple of business cases. We have a tendency to want to do too much, too soon, and too fast. And this has happened for a long time. There's managerial styles that work brilliantly in a 10-person company, but it can destroy a 1,000-person company because we haven't learned the lesson that that specific ways of doing things don't translate. This corporate cultures, I think the best example was the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick. He was a great example of a culture where when the company was nice and small, a 10-person company, it was ruthless, it was a tough culture, it was a rude culture, it was a hard-driving culture. And by the time it grew to a large company, literally anybody but him was needed when the company matured. It isn't just a flaw, but it's a reflection that a lot of things simply don't scale. And I think there's this tendency that we think things will scale. There's one, he has, as I say, he's got 23 really ideas that we've got to be aware of. We should remind ourselves of. As you read this book, you find yourself saying, aha, much more often than you say anything else. If you look, for example, we have overnight tragedies and we have long-term miracles. Miracles take a really long time. If you have a look at bad news, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, two of the biggest events in American history in the last 100 years, they both took less than an hour from start to finish. If we look at miracles, real miracles, And the fact that in 1955, 700,000 Americans died of heart disease, 700,000 in 55. That's declined by 70%. You say, one second, a decline of 70% from 700,000 people dying? Why aren't we shouting in the streets and building statues to cardiologists? The answer is because the improvement happened too slowly for anyone to notice. The average annual decline in heart disease between 1950 and 2014 was 1.5%. Now, can you imagine a news headline that says heart disease declines by 1.5% last year? 1.5%. You just yawn and move on. It's good news, but 1.5% isn't good news. 75% is good news.
Yeah, that doesn't shake you much.
Because it happens so slowly, we don't get it. And I think that many of the tragedies that happen in life are things which happen very quickly, but the miracles that happen are very, very slow. And very often the miracles are things we don't even, are the things that didn't happen. It's the terrorist attack that didn't happen. It's the car accident that didn't happen. It's the pandemic that didn't happen. Yeah, the stock market crash that didn't happen. Overnight tragedies, we all know of. Long-term miracles, we just don't know. And he's got lots and lots of good ideas. And we need to understand these ideas, we don't have to guess about.
Yeah.
They're built into where humans are, and that's why the book is useful.
All right, that was Ian Mann talking about what never changes in a changing world. Reading the book today, Same as Ever, Timeless Lessons on Risk, Opportunity, and Living a Good Life, that by Morgan Housel. A book he says he's been going back to a lot of times, a best-selling author. Welcome back to The Money Show, one of my favorite features here on the show, How I Make My Money. This time chatting to Sam TechGirl, right, an esports shoutcaster and influencer as well, digging into her pockets tonight to find out how she makes her money. Sam, welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, usually when parents see, you know, their teenage kids wrapped up in a room for hours playing esports, playing games, not wanting to be interrupted, they'd be quite, strict to say, no, look, you need to let go of these esports gaming things. You need to let go of this console and go outside and make a real living. But one can quite make a lot of money from esports, can't they?
They definitely can. And I mean, my mom was one of them. I think I was doing this job for a good 2 years, being flown overseas, everything paid for and being paid. And she kept saying to me, when are you going to start looking at getting a real job again? So I completely get the fear, because it is games, right? I mean, it's a bit like watching Netflix. It's an entertainment thing. But when it comes to certain games, they're very competitive and there is a lot of money on the line. I think just recently, a couple of weeks ago, we had the first ever CS2 major. CS2 is a game, Counter-Strike. It's the newest iteration of Counter-Strike. The prize pool for that was, if I'm not mistaken, $1.2 million, 16 teams fighting for a share of that. So you can make some really good money if you're extremely good at playing the game.
I imagine you also started off, picking up a console yourself. What was your favorite game back then as a young lady?
So my dad was a giant nerd, so we didn't have a console. We actually had a PC. So I learned to game on a PC. But the first game that I remember playing, which is probably not a good indication of his parenting, was Mortal Kombat 3. And he actually showed us at the time. The internet was kind of new in those days, but he, and I've still looked back and wonder if he should have let his young daughter do this, but he showed me how to go into forums and how I could get certain codes and put them into the game so I could get cheats for Mortal Kombat. And it ended up, there's a game called The Sims, which was more age appropriate, but I found these forums where they gave you codes and you could actually mod the codes of the game so that I could have like the members of the Spice Girls in The Sims as well. So in a weird way, him allowing me to play games on the PC actually taught me some like basic coding as well. So I always try and use that as an example that there is gaming can be worthwhile. You can actually learn stuff from it as well.
And to be clear to our listeners who are not familiar with gaming speak, mod is to modify, right?
Yeah, it's to modify. So you change the code of the game so that, for example, you could, in Mortal Kombat, if you wanted to, so there were cheats that you could use and coding and some codes that you could put in where you could turn your little characters into tiny babies. It's called a baby fatality. So you would turn the person you were fighting into a baby and then kill them, but I mean, the ethics of it is questionable, but you could do stuff like that. So I'm really selling sports as like esports as a professional way to make money right now talking about this, but there you go.
No, those are the intricacies that come with the space. I mean, I guess you had quite a great mentor in your dad, but at what point do you decide, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm not going to be a lawyer, I'm going to be somebody that's in the gaming world. This is what I really love to do, and I'd like to make money from it.
So I think for me, it wasn't really that path didn't happen. I mean, I kind of in high school stopped playing as games as much as I'd like, because obviously at the time everyone was, you know, there was a stigma around playing games. You were a nerd, you were weird. So sort of stopped it and then got back into it, but didn't really talk about it when I was in university. It wasn't something I wanted people to know because I felt a little bit judged. And then kind of as time progressed, I mean, I got 2 degrees. I was studying at journalism, and then I went and I ended up working in corporates. And it was while there that I just started using social media really just to talk about my love for technology and then games, and then proceeded to start talking about competitive gaming because my brother was quite a good South African player. And at that stage, esports had kind of blown up overseas. It had become this big business, not nearly as big as what it is now, but at the time it was really impressive. And I started using social media to highlight some of the esports stars that we had in South Africa who weren't getting the same opportunities. And again, it was one of these things where people started getting me to come on stage and give me a mic and commentate. And I was just doing it because I was getting free entry into events, and that was cool. And I got to hang out with my friends and talk about games. And then all of a sudden, people were paying me, and then suddenly, and I was laughing because I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, but you're giving me money to commentate, so I'll take the money. And then someone from overseas came and said, hey, like, we can actually, you know, we could find you work in a much bigger pool. And next thing, I was being flown overseas, and then I was quitting my job because I couldn't take so much leave to go and do jobs overseas. So this actually for me personally wasn't a career choice. It was something that just kind of happened, and now it is my full-time job. But I think a lot of people I know, especially the younger generation, because esports is more established now, it's an actual decision. They choose what they study at university in the hope that it can help aid them in a career in this, because it's not just commentating. You can obviously play professionally, you can manage teams, you can run the marketing for those teams, you can run an organization, you can get into the production of these shows, the administration behind the scenes of the actual tournament. There are so many job opportunities that now exist.
What made you take the leap then? Because you're getting, you know, probably a sizable amount from a corporate. You've got a certain amount coming in as a salary every month. And yes, you are commentating at your favorite esports events, but to then shift away from that certain world to a world you didn't know could sustain you, at what point do you make that decision?
So, I mean, I think my dad, which we mentioned, like as a mentor, I'd like to think that he taught me some things. And so what he had taught me for a long time is obviously to save. And when I made the decision to quit my corporate job, I knew that I had 3 months worth of savings available to me. And I kind of thought, well, I'm going to take a chance at this, the commentating side and the content creation side. And if in 3 months, actually wasn't 3 months, I said, if in 2 months I'm still dipping into my savings, then I've got to go find a job. Because obviously the longer you're out of the corporate world, there's always like a stigma that you won't be able to find anything. And within the first month, I was able to cover my expenses without having to pull my savings. And by the third month, I was like, hold on, I can actually make this work. I've got to work really hard, and I had to change the way I lived in some respects, but this is something that I could do. And that was kind of where the decision came from. Was originally it was I will take the 3 months, but if that doesn't work, then I'll go straight back. And I say this to a lot of people who are interested in getting into this, or people that really want to compete, because competing and playing professionally is very stressful. It's exactly like rugby. Some people are good enough. Most people aren't. I always say you need to have a backup plan. I think I was lucky because I had a tertiary education and I'd had a corporate job. So I knew that I had a CV if needed to kind of go out and find a place again if it didn't pan out.
And what is the making of an esports shoutcast? I mean, is it the same as you would have maybe a rugby pundit or a soccer commentator or an analyst?
It's pretty much the same. It is exactly the same. I think that the difference is that you need to understand how the game changes. So something that you have all the same features that you would if you were commentating on soccer, like you said, or rugby, exactly like what you see when you're watching your games. That's what we do. And it's the exact same style of broadcast. The difference is that football, the rules of football haven't changed for a very long time. It's pretty much how it started is how football is played. Games change all the time. They make tweaks to them. They add new things to it. They change maps. Sometimes they remove certain things from a game and add something new. So you've got to consistently be up to date with those things changing and understanding how the dynamics of changing the game will ultimately affect those playing it, and understanding at the top level the style of play that you're seeing from certain players, how those changes will impact them. So you do have to be a little bit more hands-on with the game itself, and understand what changes are happening versus something like football or rugby, where I think the rules will always be the same for the most part. But it is pretty much like any broadcast job. You need the same set of skills, if you like. But I do also think that you have to have an extreme love for the game that you're commentating on, because games are, I mean, a Counter-Strike match can last anything between 2 to like 4.5 hours. So you got to be dedicated to being in there and doing that. And our broadcast days can go anything again from like 6 hours all the way through to like 14, 15 hour days. So I think there's a level of love that has to come into it as well.
Athletes, top CEOs will tell you about the 10 hours that they've put into their craft, musicians at perfecting their craft. In terms of gaming, just how much time do you need to put into it? You know, how much seriousness do you need to put into it in order to make sure that you're one of the top players or some of the top analysts in the sector?
This question is so tough because I know players that are so naturally gifted I give you an example. I know a FIFA player in South Africa who's so damn good. And I know that the whole way through school, he didn't play in the week. He only played, I think, for 4 or 5 hours on a Saturday and then 4 or 5 hours on a Sunday, because that's all he was allowed to play. But he was one of the best in the world. And then on the other side, I can tell you about international players who are clocking 8 hour workdays. A lot of them are part of professional organizations. They're paid a salary. They are expected to be online playing for 8 hours a day. They work with performance coaches and psychologists and nutritionists, and they're constantly working at perfecting their craft, and they sit in coaching clinics, if you like, and playing with their teammates, not in the same way you or I would play games. So they're not just like picking up the controller and jamming for 8 hours. Like, they will sit and study past games that they've played, discuss new strategies and things like that, but it'll be a full 8 hour day. Some kids that are coming up that want to be picked up by one of these organizations, you'll see them, they'll be playing for 11, 12 hours a day trying to get noticed. So it completely comes down to whether you have the natural skill or whether you want to put the time in. But I do think, like any other sport, and I know that I wouldn't say gaming's a sport, but it is similar in the sense that some people are just really good. There's a lot of
concentration that comes with it as well, yeah.
Yeah, and some people are just really naturally good. There are guys that are 16, 17 right now that are just incredibly naturally talented. And then some people say, I want to be a professional gamer, and they play every day and they just never get to that level. So it is a difficult one. But I think, like anything, the more time you put into something, the better you're going to be at it, right?
All right. In conversation with Sam Tech Girl, right? Esports, a shoutcaster and influencer, telling us about the world of gaming. And well, there's money there too, and she's making quite a bit of it. We'll catch up with her after this.
You're with Motel Faribe on 702 and Cape Talk.
And we're talking how I make my money tonight, joined by Sam Tech Girl, right? Esports, shoutcaster and influencer as well, telling us about the world of gaming. Now, the market of gaming, according to Statista.com, is at 1.7 billion last year. That's quite a bit of money, Sam, going into this particular sector. How is the South African sector compared to the rest of the world? Are we paying the same? Are there enough talents to ship out to the rest of the world?
So the short answer is no. I think it's a little bit behind, and there's various socioeconomic reasons for that. Obviously, we have an access to technology and that I think lacks slightly. And obviously, we have a huge connectivity issue. So we're a little bit behind. For example, I could not do what I do full time if I did it only in South Africa. The majority of my work is based overseas, primarily in Europe. And I wouldn't be able to do this as a full-time job here. There just isn't enough of an infrastructure. Saying that, when I started, I was doing it in South Africa and there was no money. Everyone was a volunteer. When we used to put on these shows, there was money for the players. Sometimes it wasn't money. Sometimes it was just gear that they would win. But everyone working from the one cameraman to the commentators, we were doing it for free because we loved it. So there is a definite improvement because I do know now that people are paid. I think that they're paid reasonably well considering the experience that they have. And so you can start to build something. Also, we now have dedicated esports companies in South Africa. I think there's two that focus specifically on running events and doing broadcasts. So they are hiring people as well. So it's growing. It's just taking a little bit longer. If you look at those big numbers that you were mentioning or the stadiums that are getting filled in Europe, we don't have that just yet.
And then what's it like walking into a bank and telling them that you're into esports, you are a gamer yourself, and this is the industry you're in, you'd like to get funding either to, get assets or maybe start a business? You know, what's the treatment from some of the bankers?
So this is it's a weird one because obviously, I mean, they look at me like I'm insane. It's really difficult to explain what I do to a lot of people, and they find it. I normally just go with, oh, I'm like a TV presenter. And I mean, even that, it's not really explaining what I do, but I do struggle because I think that I've been able to do quite well for myself. I obviously predominantly earn US dollars and pounds. And I have considerable savings. But if I, for example, want to get, money for, say, a bond, or if I want to, when I'm financing a vehicle, or if I wanted to get money to start a business, I'm automatically seen as a very high risk, which I get because I live a freelance type of life. Obviously, my jobs are not guaranteed every year, but it is weird to me that I can have quite a considerable amount of money to be able to say, hey, look, this is what I'm going to put down as the deposit, and I'd still be seen as high risk. However, I think that's just the nature of the business that I'm in. And it's a difficult one because, like I said, sometimes I don't even waste my time trying to explain what I do. I just say I'm in TV, or I'm a TV presenter, because I know that the moment I try and explain what I do, there's just no legitimacy to it. People are like, well, what do you mean you just play games all day? I mean, that's kind of what they presume I'm doing, right?
So you've been part, of course, in making sure that there's a formal structure in the e-gaming space in South Africa. I mean, you were there before the industry even paid out anything. Have sponsors also jumped on? Has computer makers, some of the consoles that make some of these games come on to sort of support it and make sure that those that are interested in it can make a living?
They have. And that's what's so cool, because when I started, we did it for free. Now people get paid, and we fought hard for that. I know it sounds ridiculous, but there was a small group of us who fought really hard to say, hey, if you're going to have people working for you all day on this broadcast, like, you should probably pay them and also maybe give them lunch and some bottles of water. Always nice. So like, I like the fact that now when I go to like a Comic-Con or a Rage, I see people and they, you know, they have a makeup artist and they have like all the support that they should have to do their job better. There's also been a huge increase in big brands coming in, not just the endemic brands. So not just your PC manufacturers and your peripheral partners, but we've also seen like a lot of mainstream brands get super involved. In South Africa, you've got the likes of Doritos has got involved, a lot of the telecommunications companies. Overseas though, I mean, I love the fact that like Audi, Mercedes, Benz, they're all in the mix now. You get to see them. Even the US Air Force sponsors esports events now as a way to try, I think, get people to sign up. But we have a lot of these like mainstream sponsors, a lot of drinks companies, clothing brands as well. Gucci's just done a huge thing. So I think that a lot of corporate South Africa and corporates globally have seen the value, because you have a very dedicated viewer and fan who's going to sit for 8 to 12 hours watching their favorite players compete in these games. And they're a guaranteed audience because it's live on the internet. And you can market to them, and they have the money to spend on your products because they can afford to set themselves up with a console and a PC and play games. So it's a very lucrative business and a very dedicated fan group that's watching it, which is why I think more and more businesses are getting involved. And I get really excited because I've seen it in South Africa, and I think it's growing much faster than a lot of people thought it would, which is always a good thing, because I would like to predominantly work at home if I could.
Yeah, not traveling as much. Okay, so these days you court on stage at some of these tournaments, but also creating content and influencer content as well that's got to do with esports. But do you still pick up a console? Do you still sit in front of the gaming computer to play some of your favorite games?
Someone asked me this the other day. So in the beginning of January, I think between the middle of November and like the end of Feb, I'd only been home for like a week and a half. I'd been on the road with work. And someone said to me, what are you playing? And I just laughed. I was like, I haven't actually played a game in months. But I've been home for a little bit. So I am still playing. I am trying to get good at Counter-Strike because even though I commentated and I host a lot of events, I'm absolutely horrifically bad at it. So I've been spending a lot of my evenings playing some CS2. And then I've also got, I actually have, two consoles as well. So I jump on there sometimes. I love, the new Mortal Kombat came out and I think I finished it in a day. The story mode, it is quite short though, just cause Mortal Kombat will always like have all those great memories for me. So I do try and jump on and play where I can. It's not as much as I'd like, anymore when I'm at work, but when I have downtime, the goal is to try play some more.
All right, that was Sam Tech Girl, right? Esports shoutcaster and influencer talking to us about esports and the world of gaming, how lucrative it can be if you're really good at playing at it. And thank you so much for joining us for that particular conversation.